This is Deanna Spingola. It is Wednesday, June 27th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her website is veraiconapublishers.org, and she also has a YouTube channel. That is youtube.com/VeraIcona100. She's a fabulous author. She's got a lot of books. One of my very favorite books is The Hyenas of High Finance, which I absolutely recommend that everybody have. This really gets down to the nitty-gritty of who is financing who and where. It talks about the money powers. It's a very essential book to have, so I recommend that you purchase that book. And you can do that at Amazon.com or through the website VeraIconaPublishers.org. Welcome to the program, Veronica.
Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent. I'm doing well myself.
Good.
And real quick, we'll just start off with, I forgot to mention in our last program on the Reichstag fire, and this is very important, and anyone that gets the Fritz Tobias book can read about this, that Marinus van der Lubbe had set, I believe it was 4 or 5 separate fires before the Reichstag fire. So this is a huge, huge undermining of NS complicity in the fire, because, you know, van der Lubbe had been doing this. This was an actual kind of arson streak. And it wouldn't make sense that if the NS was responsible for just one of them and he was responsible for the other 4 or 5, no, he was responsible for all of them.
Now, what time period was this that he set the other ones?
You know, I didn't get the specifics on it. I'm going to have to reread that entire book. It's been years. I was just perusing it earlier today. I believe it was the several days before. So this would have been all in the same week.
Oh, okay.
And he was just basically going through Germany and buying these fire starters. Fritz Tobias describes exactly what those were, and they were extremely effective. And could even start, they started a roof on fire that was in fact covered with light snow. So this kid knew how to start fires. It was kind of a serial arson streak that had preceded even just those few days before. So this was an ongoing thing, and he traveled while he did it. So it didn't look like it was connected, all these fires. And all of them were put out rather quickly, except for the Reichstag fire. And that would likely be because of the material that was in that building. It
Certainly.
Just caught fire much faster. So in one of the buildings he set fire to, or he attempted to set fire to, a small fire started there, but they got it out pretty quickly, was a women's welfare organization building. Kind of strange for a communist to be burning down a welfare building.
Indeed.
Yeah. But again, nobody could pin it on the Communist Party per se, and they concluded that Marinus had done this on his own, and in fact, he was very similar to Hitler. It's interesting. There's a breakdown on their two personalities and kind of the similarities between their lives. It is fascinating, so people should read that, because it shows how one man went kind of the wrong way and fell through the cracks, and the other one was able to overcome those impediments and become a national leader. Just interesting.
It is. And sometimes I think early childhood experiences, losing a parent, and some of the other things that occurred, being in the war and having an injury that was so serious, all of those things basically made him a better person and made him a stronger person. I think strength comes from the struggle.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so the people that assessed Marinus van der Lubbe called him a lunatic and a moron, etc., because it was the bourgeoisie that was interviewing him. It was the elite. They couldn't understand what would drive a common person to do the things he did. But I think any one of us can very well understand. some people get to that desperate point and they do the things that Marinus did. So that, you know, people have got to get that Fritz Tobias book. It's probably on Scribd. I'm sure there's got to be something online of that book, I'm sure.
Okay.
Because it's out of print and it's very rare. I think I spent at least $100 to get my copy. It was not cheap. But if people can get it, because it totally undermines all the lies.
Okay. And that book is called...
I believe it's called The Reichstag Fire.
The Reichstag Fire, yes. By Fritz Tobias, Martin Secker, and Warburg Limited, and it came out in 1964. Mm-hmm. I do have a copy. I don't know whether I have whether mine is the real copy or the PDF file, because okay. I have a lot of PDF files. But it could be the PDF file, and I could have gotten it on Scribd.
And that's good enough. Somebody may have just scanned the book and stuck it as a PDF. So that's fine. But that really undermines the whole thing. And Tobias was not pro-National Socialist. That's very important.
It is. Definitely.
He can't implicate the communists or the NSDAP. And see, the communists blame the NSDAP and the NSDAP blame the communists.
Right.
So, and they both had reasons for doing that. As we know, democracy is basically a game of perception management. Whoever can fool the people wins. Whoever can kind of manage the perception of an event wins. So the communists and National Socialists were doing this to their advantage. However, Tobias could only pin it on van der Lubbe.
Hmm.
But the Leica did have a connection there somehow, because Mauro Giafferi or Giafferi, however you say that name, that man showed up at the trial, and he's the one that screamed that Goering was the incendiary. And Halder, the lying traitor, said at Nuremberg that Goering casually remarked at dinner that he had been the incendiary after all, and then slapped his thigh. I'm sorry, that does not count.
Right.
Halder was a lying traitor, excuse me, but garbage bag. Horrible, yes. Human being who lied incessantly in his diary.
Right. And of course, anything that came out at Nuremberg is to be, abandoned or simply disregarded, pretty much.
Yeah, one has to be very careful. So right. Anyone that relies on Halder, that doesn't work. So.
All righty. I noticed that on your website you cover Karen Klein.
Uh-huh.
The bus monitor.
Yes.
That was such a story. Unbelievable,
yeah.
Story.
You know, I've been around kids, I've worked around kids, and just the disrespect, it's incredible. We got to start doing something about that. This whole child-centric American mentality, it's got to go.
Yes.
Children are to be raised to become adults. For some reason, we've lost this somewhere along the way, that childhood is where you act like an irresponsible little creep. And that's just not how it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be raising our children to become responsible adults, and it's a process. But you don't let them get away with this kind of nonsense.
Yes.
So.
And to treat an elderly person, an older person like that.
Oh, yeah. I was outraged.
Me too.
Yeah, why I put it on there. It really made me mad. So
good for you.
Okay. So moving on, we'll go with Goebbels Tagebucher notes. These I just finished. We have some more anomalies, and this is in regards to Kristallnacht and how Goebbels allegedly, you know, orchestrated this whole thing. So on November 10th, 1938, as Goebbels is allegedly driving back to his hotel, which didn't in fact happen, we said last time that he went to the Munich railway station from the Old Town Hall and from there to Berlin. He says that quote, the synagogues of every major city are burning, end quote. Well, we know he didn't actually see this because he traveled directly to Berlin from Munich. So how did he know this? And that no German property was threatened by these fires when he didn't receive any reports until the next morning. And he acknowledges this. I received the reports the next day. So, and of course, there's no time given on the 10th. Well, he didn't even get these reports until the 11th. So how did he know that synagogues in every major city were burning?
Exactly.
It's more of the chronological nonsense. He allegedly wrote also that, quote, the whole nation was in turmoil, end quote, which is nonsense. There's a book I'm reading right now. Oh, I can't remember the title. I don't have it in the room with me, but I think it's 48 Hours of Kristallnacht. And it's by the director of Yad Vashem or something like that. But this guy even has to acknowledge in many of the different accounts written by Jews well after the fact that are part of the Wiener Library Collection in London, that a lot of these Jews had no idea what was going on. They were untouched by Kristallnacht or any events thereof. So this is nonsense that the entire nation's in turmoil. Goebbels wouldn't say something that silly. Many people, including Jews, hadn't even heard anything or knew anything was even going on. Okay, Hitler didn't even know, which is corroborated by the several eyewitnesses that were in the apartment with him when he finally received the news. And he's going, "What is going on here?" So this is just absolute rubbish. Goebbels would not have known this, and he certainly wouldn't have written it at the time. And of course, most of the provocations took place, as we've gone over, in remote villages and towns in Hesse, Thuringia, Lower Saxony, the southern portion, and the upper parts of Bavaria. It is concentrated very much so in this certain area of the Reich. And again, one need only look up that map on Kristallnacht, and you will see the plotting of the various incidents.
Right, and you mentioned the last time that we spoke that only the Jewish people would know where these people lived in the rural areas. Usually, they would congregate in the urban areas, but there were Jews who were living outside of big cities. And
Right.
yes.
Yes, and some of the Jews that gave testimonies to the that are published in this Yad Vashem book, they say that the Gestapo or police or whoever it was that broke into their house, they're always very vague and they never have names. They come in with these elaborate, detailed lists of all the Jews in the community, but then other Jews said that that didn't happen, didn't mention any lists. None of their stories accord with other people's stories. So they didn't think about that before they started lying. And it's obvious they're lying. Most of these accounts can be torn apart. And, you know, we can go through a few of those in a future show, but it's bad. It's really bad. Never any names, no details. It is not for no reason that the post-war trials over Kristallnacht were almost completely acquitted, dismissed, etc. There was no evidence. You can't just say, yeah, it was some Gestapo such and such. I'm not, you know, I don't remember his name. And the West Germans are expected to conduct a serious trial with that kind of nonsensical evidence. You know, once you read these accounts, you see why nothing really happened.
Right.
That there were just not very many perpetrators who could be implicated in anything because it was lies. The incidents were concentrated in the west part of Germany, many on or close to the French and Swiss borders, and Belgium, of course, and mostly around the city of Frankfurt. Now, Frankfurt is about 200 miles from Munich, which is in the southeast of the country. So this is strange. Again, the NSDAP being behind this would not, it doesn't make sense that they would have had these events so far away from the center of power because they were all in this old town event to celebrate the March on the Feldherrnhalle thing, you know, Hitler's pooch. They're like 200 miles away from the events. That is just nonsensical.
It is.
It makes more sense for an outside agitator to have chosen those locations where the police could not get there quickly enough and the fire brigades.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that you would have maximum destruction. And it wouldn't get back to Munich until quite a while later. And that is exactly what happened. Most of the leaders didn't know what was going on until the next day. They didn't know the full extent. So we need to think about this. It does not make sense for the NSDAP to have done this.
Certainly. And the books that were written about this event are all, well, they're all written by people that that certainly have an interest, such people as Alan E. Steinweiss. And yes, it's,
Yes.
and it,
Who's
and
endorsed by all Jewish historians on the back cover?
certainly.
Yeah. What's funny is the Jews don't ever call anyone out on that. They don't go, "Hey, we have ideological interests behind our reviews and behind our history." But if somebody is like particularly interested in fascism or national socialism, or they're supported by certain groups or organizations, let's just say someone's essay ends up on Stormfront or something, they immediately point out, "Well, look at the source.
Right.
Look at who's writing it. It's a fascist or a pro-fascist." It's like, well, what do you think you're doing?
Right.
You're a Jutzi. You're a
Right.
Zionist, you know, whatever the case is. So that's just, you can't go ad hominem. It doesn't matter what somebody's ideology is. You got to look at the content.
Right. And this was put out by the Yad Vashem, or
His wasn't. His is Harvard. And
oh,
the
okay.
other one is Yad Vashem. That's 48 hours of Kristallnacht.
Okay.
I can't think of that author's name off the bat, but he's the head of Yad Vashem, and it's published in accordance with them.
Mitchell G. Bard, Bard.
That's it. Yeah. And the Steinweiss book is Kristallnacht 1938, and that's Harvard University Press. So, yeah. All right. So Goebbels calls the quote-unquote pogrom an exercise or practice in this same entry on November 10th. He uses the German term Übung, which is like a U-umlaut and then B-U-N-G. I'll have Wilfried look over that, but that term is strange to me. It doesn't sound right in the context. It sounds like something that a person who doesn't know German very well would use. So that stood out to me. And again, my German isn't strong enough to know when a word is used wrongly in, you know, all cases. So, but that one struck me. It sounds out of place and incorrect for the context time period. So that we need to follow up on. Übung.
Yes, I have a friend in Florida that I sent a couple of paragraphs just in the last week to, and he said the basically the same thing about what I sent to him. He said, this was not written by anybody that knows German.
Right. Yeah.
So.
It would be like if we used, "I want to deliver an address as though it was deliver a letter." There's, you know, in English, verbs have to go, certain verbs have to go with certain things. Same thing in German. You wouldn't say, "I'm going to deliver a letter," the same way as "I'm going to deliver an address over the microphone," a speech, if you will. German much more so than English, where you can use the same verb for a lot of things. But there's some cases where in English you would know that a foreigner said it and you're like, no, that's not the right verb here. So we've got to be really, really stringent about that, because the person that went through these diaries is that Elke Fröhlich, I think her name is. Yeah, Elke Fröhlich. We can't trust her because she works at the IFZ. She's going to overlook any kind of strange things. In fact, she's the one who went, "Yeah, no one could figure out what Hitler's Stoßtrupp was. It just, what is this? You know, this is very strange." And Goebbels used it and can't make the connection that, wow, this is incorrect.
Right.
Somebody like from the Soviet intelligence organization wrote this.
Right. And
No, no, no. She acts like Goebbels did.
didn't you say that they hadn't used that phrase since 1923 or so?
Yes. And she says this is the smoking gun. Puts it out as a smoking gun that Goebbels orchestrated Kristallnacht. instead of saying, wait a minute here, this term fell out of use a long time ago. Why would you bring that back up? Yeah, no logical conclusions coming from that one. So Goebbels then allegedly writes that it's raining new messages and uses the term regnet, which means literally it's raining. Again, we need to check up on that. Would he use such a word? You know, only a really good German, a native German speaker and researcher will know. Would Goebbels have said something like that? Was that the kind of turn of phrase that you'd use in German? We can say raining cats and dogs here.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say that in German, does it make the same kind of sense, or is there a completely different phrase you'd say? So that's one we need to look into. He then goes on to write that he spoke with Hitler about the, quote, current measures, end quote, ultimately asking, quote, shall we let this go on or end it, end quote. Now, current measures, I guess that's in reference to the burning synagogues, et cetera, that he's ordered. And again, would someone write such state secrets in their personal diary? He's basically implicating himself and Hitler in his diary. This is a little strange, knowing that from, you know, the Wikipedia report that Goebbels wanted to make sure those diaries were gone back over at some point.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
And he put them in a vault.
Yeah. In that he should be less frank about personal matters, but they weren't doctored. The 1938 entries weren't doctored. Well, why not? You mean he didn't go back and become less frank in those other entries when he had started to, you know, later on? And on top of that, Goebbels started dictating to a stenographer. He didn't even write his later diaries. There are huge issues with the whole entire Goebbels diary set. So we got to be really careful. But yeah, I mean, the fact that he realized that this diary constituted a remarkable historical document, but didn't think to remove pogrom references that would incriminate him.
Yes.
Not likely. So Goebbels and Weckert both mention the Britzi partition of Palestine, the very thing this pogrom may have been orchestrated to address, where the Zionist Jutsis trying to conjure Britzi sympathy via this pogrom. This is what Weckert wants to know. Basically, what was going on is the British were going to have a vote on the partition of Palestine. Are we going to let Jews have this, et cetera, et cetera? And so the Zionists, it would have been in their interest, especially Mr. Weizmann, to create as much sympathy as possible on the British side so that they would indeed get this through.
Of course. We always have to see, all right, who benefits? No matter
right.
what event has occurred, who benefits from this?
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is it did ultimately fail because the British went ahead and said, no, we're not going to do it. We're not going to give this to Jews. But it was not for want of trying. So what might these Jutsis do next to conjure the quote-unquote flashpoint of sympathy needed to acquire Palestine, I say, for Jutsism? If not a pogrom, then war. So then we start getting into Gleiwitz, the exploitation of anti-Semitic Poland. The Jews may well have wanted revenge against Poland and helped kind of orchestrate the whole Gleiwitz perception management, which again, I suspect was a radio deception. Nothing actually took place at Gleiwitz. As difficult as that is to understand and for people to get their head around, nothing happened. There was just a murder of this Hanzik man left at the scene, and nobody knew what exactly had happened there. There were eyewitnesses that said nothing happened at all. They didn't hear any shooting, nothing. They're like, what are you talking about? The Gestapo and the SS was here. No, they weren't. No one was. So, you know, we have huge problems with that whole thing. But of course, you know, the whole idea is that the Zionists were trying to get that flashpoint, that turning point, to get the British and whoever else would go along with that Palestine grab. They ultimately got it with the Holocaust.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. And the quote-unquote death marches that were actually supported by the Allies. The Allies negotiated with the Germans to evacuate as many Jews as possible from the Soviet zone, which is in those Allied documents that, you know, I posted on the site in that one post about this. So these weren't death marches. These were, you know, arranged by the Allies and the Germans, and the Allies were assured by the Germans that nothing was going on in these camps. No, there's no mass extermination going on. It's nonsense. It's rumor. The Allies go, okay, yeah, we accept that. Okay, go ahead and evacuate these people west. And that's exactly what they did.
Right.
So, you know, they finally got their flashpoint, didn't they? You know, this whole refugee crisis.
Certainly.
We were mass exterminated. You got to give us Palestine. Because this will happen again. And of course, now it's happening again anyway, right? Iran's going to have a Holocaust.
Right.
The Palestinians are going to have a Holocaust. I mean, no matter where these people go and whether or not they have a country, there's always going to be some Holocaust out to get them. It's like, well, you just shot yourself in the foot because now you've got your state and you still aren't happy.
Indeed.
It's just nonsense.
It is. And who has threatened him? Seriously. I mean, the only thing that they can say about Iran is Ahmadinejad had the conference, when was it, in 2006?
Yeah.
And basically said the Holocaust didn't happen like they're telling it.
Right.
And so, of course, that means that they've got to silence the people in Iran.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, even if they were put in Madagascar, it'd still be a problem.
Sure.
Yeah, so, okay, so moving on. November 11th, 1938, this is now Friday. Goebbels notes that it just so happens to be Heinrich Müller who informs him of the Vorgänge in Berlin. Müller, who had absolutely no authority over all the state police agencies, unlike Heydrich, is the one that tells him this. Not likely. And the thing is Mueller's telex is a fraud, as we know. So he's supposedly telling Goebbels about the actions in Berlin. No, I don't think so. His name was likely dropped in there by Moscow since it corresponds with, you know, that is, corroborates the fraudulent Mueller telex written by the Allied Psychological Warfare Division. That's exposed by Weckert. The certified VOPI. You know, all this stuff. The Allies couldn't even spell copyright. They put VOPI. It's just this kind of nonsense. And they call Heydrich Heyer. It's like, no, his name wasn't H-E-Y-E-R. You messed that one up. Just terrible, idiotic mistakes in both of those telexes. This telex, like Heydrich's fake telex, and Goebbels' November 10th diary entry mentions the planned arrest of exactly 20,000 to 30,000 Jutsis. This meant the arrest of between about 624 and 1,500 Jutsis per hour nonstop.
How could that happen?
Please. I mean, even 600 an hour.
Exactly.
That's giving them two full days. If you give them the actual time allotted that it actually took place, it would be 1,500 per hour, nonstop, the whole entire time. Didn't happen.
Oh.
They just invented that figure.
Well, they're good at inventing figures now, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, 20 to 30,000? Why would someone even put that in a telex? Plan to arrest 20 to 30,000 Jews. Not sure when, where, how, or why, but just do it. Who was counting? Was somebody officially tabulating? Okay, wait, you guys, that's 30,001. Stop. You got one too many. People, you got to start thinking about the inanity of this.
Yes.
And of course, Hitler's supposedly the one that said that, yeah, arrest 20 to 30,000 Jews. You know, as soon as he says it, it's like God speaking. He need only speak evil and it's done. So what's more, Mueller tells Goebbels that the results are fire upon fire, which Goebbels writes is just fine. Yeah, this is dandy. Not likely, since German insurance companies would suffer from this destruction. This was exactly why that air ministry meeting was held. So, hence, the air ministry meeting, during which Goering fumed over the destruction, he was furious. And so his duty was to somehow work out this insurance thing, okay? And they couldn't implicate any National Socialists because they didn't order it. This wasn't their thing. So they ended up making the Jews pay for it. And that's, you know, that's what happened on that November 12th air ministry meeting. Goebbels then allegedly confers with Hitler about the actions to make Jews pay dearly, quote unquote, with the fires, etc., to which Hitler completely agrees.
And,
we're going to burn them and kill them. Oh, great. That's Hitler. Oh, fantastic. I don't think so.
Right.
And the action. Yeah,
all these details are so important.
Oh, yeah. Goebbels allegedly says, quote unquote, the action is running perfectly. No, it was chaotic. It was idiotic. It was totally disorganized. So no, it wasn't running perfectly. And right after he says this, he says 17 Jews are dead. So we're supposed to go, oh, he thinks it's perfect because 17 Jews have lost their lives. And Hitler is simply thrilled at this. Oh, dead Jews. Great. Continue with the quote unquote severe measures taken against the Jews until you order a stop to the action, Goebbels. So Goebbels is saying Hitler's in complete compliance, loves the fact that we have 17 dead Jews already. He says, keep taking severe measures until I order a stop to it. That's inane. It's
absolutely
just more of this idiocy. So let me skip up to Weckert here real quick. Contrary to Goebbels in his diary, Weckert notes that Hitler lamented, quote, they have ruined everything for me like elephants in a china shop. It's terrible. And then, quote, I had the great hope that I was about to come to an understanding with France, and now this, end quote. So while at his apartment, he ordered von Eberstein and other police agencies to halt this madness, quote unquote. Hess was told by Hitler to issue a telex along these lines, which went out to all regional party command centers. Now, this alone indicates that Hitler did not know who exactly was behind these acts. Was it the party, the SA, the SS? He didn't know, so he made sure every single agency was notified to immediately stop the nonsense, prevent looting, prevent destruction, fire brigades everywhere, put out these fires, and take Jews into protective custody if necessary to protect them. Their lives must be protected. That's coming from Hitler. He also ordered Himmler to protect Jewish lives and property. Heydrich ordered that Jews in immediate danger be taken into protective custody. Now see, the Jews claim that they were arrested for no reason at all. Not true. Many Jutsis requested to be taken into protective custody for fear of their lives, and they were released the next day.
Ah!
They were only taken, they really were taken into protective custody. This wasn't the Gestapo going, ooh, let's use the acronym protective custody to cover our crimes. That's an American thing. When you're taken by the U.S. government into protective custody, you must be very afraid.
Exactly.
Not so with the, unless you were a communist, not the case in National Socialist Germany. And even when the communists were taken into protective custody, Torgler was set free and Thälmann survived the war. So he wasn't killed in a concentration camp. And those were two of the very prominent communist leaders. So even they were treated very well.
Right.
Were you going to say something?
You know, it's very interesting. If you look at the composition of the American government at that time, we had a lot of communists that had infiltrated the government in this country. And I just, I think that's interesting that they started immediately as soon as this infiltration began, they started vilifying Germany. And so this was the very, very last thing that the Germans would have done because they didn't want any more vilification.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And I think Hitler and company were aware that the communists were subversive and would do similar things if they were allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
So any ex-communists such as Torgler were basically given very powerless positions. They were still allowed to earn a living, etc., but they just weren't given prominent positions of power because they just weren't trusted. Not
and
to
for
relapse.
Good reason. For
exactly.
Good reason.
Yeah. The Haunted Wood is a good book about that. The infiltration was incredible in the U.S. government.
Indeed.
So Goebbels notes on November 11th that the insurance companies pay the Jews nothing. But he could not have known this on the 11th because, number one, Goering and not he was in charge of all aspects of the Jewish question. Second, the meeting that dealt with this issue did not take place on or before November 11th, but on November 12th. The report to Goering by the Party Supreme Court was only available on February 13th, 1939. And number three, the conference in the Ministry of the Interior, which centered on Frick and the process of Germanization and Jutsi emigration, did not take place until December 16th. 1938. Insurance issues were also discussed at this ministry meeting. So, whoops, we jumped the gun again. Goebbels wouldn't be saying that on the 11th.
No.
It took a while to investigate this whole situation, and they weren't done with the official investigation and what all would, come down until February 13th, 1939. So, it's just this kind of chronological nonsense. Goebbels also mentions he gave out quote-unquote secret decrees, but not one has ever been found. What secret decrees?
Maybe they were in code.
Yeah.
The Germans
Morse
are really,
code.
Yeah, really good at
he
that.
He winked and nodded. Unbelievable. Frick's statements at the Ministry of the Interior exposed this entry in the Tagebücher as a fraud. Jews were to be fairly compensated and no exploitation would go unpunished. So it's nonsense that, the Germans were just going to steal all their stuff and not compensate them for anything and treat them like garbage. No, absolutely not. Frick spoke out about that at length. On November 11th also, Goebbels writes that he did further work at the hotel. Which hotel, we don't know, nor what time. He writes directly after this sentence that he, quote, still gives out a pair of broadcasts or a couple of broadcasts, end quote. The verb used here is herausgeben, which, it could be incorrect here. His sentence literally translates in English as, I give still a pair of broadcasts out. And basically, with German, it does not translate directly. Everything's switched around. But is it give out or publish? What would be the more appropriate verb here? I'm not sure if herausgeben is correct or geben would be correct. So again, I need a German person to determine that. Because ausgeben means to issue or to give out. Perhaps even the verb deliver would have been more appropriate
mm-hmm.
here. Because what he's saying, and I already went over this with Wilf before the program, he literally says in German, ich gebe noch ein paar Rundrufe heraus. And the term Rundrufe is not, that just wasn't used. Wilf said, no way. Rundfunk is like a radio broadcast.
Oh.
Rundfunke would be the plural, and he says Rundrufe. That doesn't even come up in a standard modern translation. So that's very suspect. Again, somebody who doesn't really know common German terminology or correct German terminology. Here's a real beauty. I can't believe this, but Goebbels misspells Heydrich's name. in his 11th entry twice. He calls him Heiderich. He has one too many E's. He does it again several times later, constantly calling him Heiderich. Now, why would Goebbels misspell Reinhard Heydrich's name?
Exactly. And
That
they're
is totally senseless.
right. And they're very good about their grammar and their speech and very exact. He wouldn't have done that.
I don't think so. And then Goebbels claims to have spoken with Heiderich, saying his reports confirm his own information. You know, Heiderich's reports confirm what I think, which they do not. Heiderich's report indicated that 36 Jews were reported dead, the official being 91, which allegedly Heiderich also said in some report that either 267 or 177 synagogues were destroyed. Historians aren't sure which. And 844 or 7,500 shops and businesses were demolished. Again, depending on which historian you read, we're not quite
Amazing.
sure. No one knows. No one knows the exact numbers of anything, which is very strange to me.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like the Herschel Grinspan murder scene. Did he say, "I've come to avenge Jews," like David Frankfurter did before he shot Wilhelm Gustloff? Did he shoot twice? Five times? No, three times. I mean, every single account is different, depending on which historian you read.
But isn't that designed basically to confuse the entire issue?
It seems like it, yeah. We have like 16 different death figures here. I mean, and the Jews always go thousands of synagogues. First of all, the fact that thousands of synagogues, actually it was only four, it was just over 1400, but thousands of synagogues existed up until 1938 should be a red flag to anyone who says that Jews were viciously and ruthlessly persecuted up to 1938. That
Right.
right there undermines their own nonsense. But there were only 1,400. So, no, thousands of synagogues could not have possibly been burned or damaged. They didn't exist. And of course, Weckert takes to task the individual who was commissioned by a Jewish organization. It might have been Yad Vashem, to say that there were thousands, you know, literally like several thousand synagogues. She goes, She completely undermined that in one of her chapters, so we can dismiss that little report. He basically counted post-war synagogues that were built after the war ended. Any building, it didn't matter what it was, anywhere where a Jews had congregated for anything was counted as a synagogue.
Ah, even
That's
if
how
it
he
was
got away
above the
with
store or something.
Exactly. That's how he got away with that little study. Okay, so moving on, we're getting to the really good part here. Okay, so Weckert was not allowed to view this NS Party Supreme Court report that talks about these various figures, but Steinweiss was. He was allowed.
Huh.
And what he found is, I put, laughable. Okay, let's see. I'm looking at his book. Okay, so he says, right here, one especially detailed account of Goebbels's instructions is contained in a report produced in February 1939 by the High Court of the NS Party, which had carried out an investigation of some aspects of the Kristallnacht. So we must understand the NS Supreme Court carried out an investigation to bring the perpetrators of the Kristallnacht to justice.
Yes, exactly.
All right, but can we trust it? Here's what we got. This fell into Allied hands, by the way. Always a favorite. The version of events presented in the report by the NS Supreme Court is consistent with the above quoted entry in Goebbels's diary. So, first tip off, it's consistent with his fraudulent diary that's been doctored. Okay, let's see what else it says. On one key point, Goebbels told the assembled party leaders that even though Hitler had made his decision in response to Goebbels's suggestion, the authorization to unleash a pogrom had come from the Führer himself. Now, did the NS Party court really just indict Adolf Hitler for Kristallnacht. I doubt it.
I do. I doubt that.
This has been doctored.
Of course.
This has been doctored. So how does Steinweiss account for this? Here's what else he says. Goebbels stated that Hitler had decided that the anti-Jewish riots, quote, were not to be prepared or organized by the party, unquote. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. They're not to be organized or prepared by the party. So how did the party order the Jewish riots then? The anti-Jewish riots. Okay, we're having some trouble here. And, quote, insofar as they originated spontaneously, were not to be interfered with, end quote. So Hitler's going, okay, I want to have a pogrom, but we can't actually order it, okay? It cannot be traced to any one of us, even though my high court just indicted me.
Right.
They have to be spontaneous. How we determine whether or not they're spontaneous, I'm not sure. I guess we'll just assume, don't interfere with it. So in other words, those orders I just issued from my apartment to stop all these anti-Jewish actions, that was me just being fake. I was. The High Court unambiguously concluded that Goebbels' formulation had been a transparent attempt at establishing plausible deniability for himself, Hitler, and the party. That's incredible. So he falls back on that plausible deniability thing. Here's the best part. The verbally communicated instructions of the Reich propaganda leader, that is Goebbels, the supposedly NS High Court said this, were interpreted by all of the party leaders who were present. Remember, some of them had left, so there were only a few left, to mean that the party not appear to be the originator of the demonstrations, but should in fact organize and implement them. What? So the High Court just indicted its own party, its own creators. And make sure you can't be tied to it, you guys. That's what the report concluded. They had to do this verbally only over the telephone, mind you. So there's never anything documented or written down. Can't have that. It's just like the Holocaust. Hitler winked at Himmler, just gave him that wink over dinner. Said, and Himmler just read between the lines. He knew. This is the kind of insanity. And he even says that. So there couldn't be any printed instructions to recite over the phone. This is supposed to be why the National Socialists did such an idiotic job issuing these orders, which all contradicted each other. Because nobody could write anything down because Hitler wanted to make sure he couldn't be tied to Kristallnacht. What would the tyrant care? We're all told he was such a horrible tyrant. What did he care? So, the High Court ends up indicting the SS. We don't know what's real and what isn't, but this is really incredible. This report's judgment, issued in February 39, remained a secret until it was discovered in NS archives after the war by the Allies.
Oh, well.
Can you believe it? Thank goodness for the Americans.
So they could get it all out in the open.
Listen to this part. This is Steinweiss. NS leaders had learned how to protect the party from the legal repercussions of illegal demonstrations and other actions. They did so by formulating orders in a vague and imprecise manner so as to preserve plausible deniability for the party when its members were instructed to do something illegal. Okay, this is insane.
It is. And how does he know this?
He's no citation on this. He's just saying it based on. But here's the problem. Steinweiss is looking at this report so innocent with those innocent puritanical eyes of pure objectivity. And he's going, this is 100% real. There is no fraud here. This is legitimate. And so he's trying to explain it. And he can't. He can't explain the document because it's partially fraudulent, which is obvious to somebody who really knows. Listen to what he concludes. This is just insane. For their part, the lower level members of the movement had learned how to read between the lines of such orders. Like I said, wink and nod over dinner.
He actually wrote this.
He actually wrote this, understanding that the wishes of the party leadership did not necessarily correspond to the text of their instructions. What? So when Hitler goes, "Don't have a pogrom," what he really means is, "Go have a pogrom."
Oh,
I don't know.
Goodness.
This book has really been a beauty. I have notes written all over in it. My copy is destroyed, but it has to be that way. So basically, in this report, we don't know what's real, what isn't. Well, actually, we do. Basically, the report, it simultaneously whitewashes and indicts the NSDAP. Where it quote-unquote whitewashes, according to Steinweiss, that's where it's telling the truth. That's the real, legitimate part of the report. The part that indicts the NSDAP is fake. How do I know that? Because would the NS Supreme Court indict its own leader and party? No, it wouldn't. I cannot buy it. I just can't believe that they'd indict their own leader. He was the one that did it, but we'll keep that secret.
Right.
And they made sure. Now, here's the other thing. There is no way Hitler would have let that fall into Allied hands after the war. That would have been document number one to burn.
Of course.
So, you know, they would have burned that along with the Holocaust order that was burned, you know.
Right.
You know, if Hitler's going to try to exonerate himself of ordering the Holocaust, then he certainly would have exonerated himself of Kristallnacht. But oops, forgot that report, Führer. And then, of course, the archives of this NS Party High Court fell into American hands. So that's really great.
So
can't
we
trust
have,
it.
Yes. So we have them making all of these decisions or coming to all of these conclusions, doctoring whatever they want so that they can put all the blame on the Germans for everything. If they're going to put blame on the Germans for the Holocaust and for all of those other things, you have to conclude that they would also put all the blame on the Germans for Kristallnacht.
Sure. Yeah. And everything else. The Reichstag fire.
Sure.
Everyone still goes, it had to be Hitler.
And Gleiwitz, everything.
Let's
blame them for every single thing.
Right. At some point, and this is what led me to start questioning, at some point you go, no government is this bad. And no person is this bad. It was an endless string of insanity and horror. And you just go, they overplayed their hand. The
right.
Allies and Jutsis overplayed their victim hand and the horror hand, if you will. When Hitler starts looking like Pinhead from Hellraiser, we need to question. You know, that's the kind of stuff straight out of a Clive Barker film, as
right.
I've said before. It's just crazy. Moving on, this whole essay case. Now, you know, everyone wants to go, the brown shirts did it. Okay, well, some brown shirts did partake of this, but they received orders to do so from Munich headquarters. And as we know, the caller was never identified. Now, Weckert leaves it open. She goes, we'll likely never know who this person was or who these people were. But that doesn't stop Steinweiss from naming the one. So I'm having Wilf look into this right now. He's going to be our little contact point. So the whole essay case rests on an 11 February 1948 court case against a certain Johann Heinrich Bimker. That's O with an umlaut.
Okay.
And his subordinate, Rümpagel. If this verdict case is undermined, the essay guilt / responsibility completely collapses and the Jutsis are left with nothing. So I'm having him look into what the verdict was. And of course, I hope that we can get a copy of this case. I want to know who pointed a finger, speaking German now, a finger at Bimker and Rümpagel. Who implicated whom? We got to find out.
And how, and when were they in the Allies' hands and what?
Exactly. Well,
Yes.
they were tried by the West German court.
Yes.
Now, some of those were legitimate trials, but some of them weren't. And Weckert went through several of them. And she goes, "This, they just can't be trusted, because if an innocent passerby merely had something thrown out of a window in front of them or around them as they were walking and thought, that's awful, and sympathized with what was going on the for the Jews, sympathized with the Jews, and said, I'm taking this straight to the police station. How dare these creeps?" That person was later indicted for looting and fined, even though they proclaim their innocence unto the very end. And she goes through one case in particular, but she said you can repeat this many times in those post-war trials. So we have to be very careful. We need to find out what the verdict was, and preferably, if possible, find out who implicated these people. Was it Bimker's rival? Was it somebody who had been snubbed by him once? That's what we got to find out, because that's very important. And of course, back to Goebbels, he writes that, quote unquote, unpleasant excesses only occurred in Bremen. So what? The rape, theft, and murder outside of Bremen, if these even occurred in Bremen itself, weren't unpleasant excesses? Goebbels would not write such a thing. There were cases of rape. There were, not widespread. That was very deviant. Excessive looting, theft, murder, those were punished
This
severely.
rape doesn't match the German character.
Exactly. And he's going, yeah, this only those kind of things. He doesn't even say, he just says unpleasant excesses. No, they didn't only occur in Bremen. And how did he know that? So, again, we're getting these crazy things coming from Goebbels, which I don't think ever came from Goebbels. He then writes, "The time to end the great action is now." And I believe he uses the term Großaktion, which is literally great action. And he'll issue orders along this line to the police and the party. On whose authority? His own? He's going to tell the police to stop as the propaganda minister and the Gauleiter of Berlin? He doesn't have that kind of authority. So that's nonsense. And of course, on November 12th, he, whoops, misspells Sauckel's name.
He
Fritz
really has a
Sauckel.
problem, doesn't he?
Yeah, he apparently couldn't spell anyone's name right. So Fritz Sauckel misspelled his name, spelled it just with a K. Of course, the IFZ was very diligent and corrected that for us. But you know what? I appreciate the IFZ for noting that it's a correction. Did they do that on purpose to covertly wink and nod at us? Maybe. That's a good thing, because if they hadn't put that in there, we would not know that. So that's a good thing. Maybe the Germans are secretly and quietly giving a little hint. Goebbels misspells Demandowski's name as well, spells it with an I instead of a Y. And then there's another strange one on the 12th. Goebbels leaves out a woman's name who he's talking to. All we get is Frau and then three dots in a bracket. Was her name removed just in case she didn't or couldn't corroborate this entry? Example, could the woman in question even have met with and spoken to Joseph that day? That's something we got to ask ourselves. Why was that name removed? Okay, so, and then Goebbels notes on the 13th that Heydrich, name misspelled again, reported just 190 synagogues destroyed. He also mentions a conference with Goering on the Jewish question, which actually took place the day before on November 12th. So he's off by a day. Heydrich allegedly wrote Goering that 191, not 190 synagogues had been destroyed. Why the discrepancy? I'm not sure. And then we're getting down to the wire here. On the 14th, Goebbels notes that the German people are in agreement with the increasing restrictions on Jews. His articles are well received by average Germans. So I actually think this is legitimate. And what it suggests is a bottom to top pressure on the NSDAP. And I'm going to stand by this thesis 100% to get stricter with the Jews, not a top down incitation of the German people. There were still about 100,000 Jewish businesses before Kristallnacht. Jews had guns until 1938. And emigration was not pushed until 1938. There are other examples. Even if you go through these accounts that are in that Yad Vashem 48 Hours of Kristallnacht book, many Jews admit to having NS tenants. They were their landlords and employees. So what I suspect is many of the events that did happen were spontaneous. Others were planned by unknown provocateurs, Zionist connected, Jutzi connected. The spontaneous ones were in reaction to the Vom Rath death. You do not get to go around shooting our diplomats. This is the second time, no more, because the Frankfurter thing had happened in 1936.
Right.
So the German people were angry, especially probably lower NSDAP members. We know for a fact the SA was getting agitated with the fact that Jews were still in these powerful positions. And they wanted answers. That's it, Mr. Hitler. And Heinrich Pudor, the hyenas of high finance, he's one of them. Pogroms. We must have pogroms. You get these Jews out of here. I want violent anti-Semitism. Forget this, you know, sweet talk to these Jews. Throw them out. He wanted like an immediate violent answer to the Jewish question. Hitler was more diplomatic. Let's take our time. Let's do it by law, which was the reason for the Nuremberg laws and the increasing squeeze on the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Financial, political, okay, I'm going to slowly dismiss them. That wasn't good enough by the time the Vom Rath murder occurred. And from the bottom up, there was a pressuring on Hitler to do something. Okay, time to start cracking down, Führer. No more of this nonsense. So there's nobody's going to tell me that Hitler couldn't be pressured. And I've written this in Black Nazis. The Rosenstrasse protest, the Gestapo, not the Jewish women, the wives of these Jews who were incarcerated, backed down. The Gestapo backed down. So they could be pressured.
Exactly. And for good reason. I mean, look at the situation that they had lived under for a very long time. Basically, since the 1848, there had been problems in Germany.
Exactly. So this is the explanation for the increased Aryanization of Jewish property, the increase in emigration. That's why it happened, because of the bottom-up pressure. And see, Hitler didn't know this was provoked by outside forces. Neither did Goebbels. No one knew. But as Weckert suggests, Goebbels must have started asking himself questions. What exactly happened here?
Right.
This is strange. Real quick, on the 15th, Goebbels claims to publish, quote-unquote, new laws for Sudetenland. Did he have the authority? And which laws were those? He's not clear in his diary. So, and of course, he notes, thank God that they were able to escape fire damage around the synagogues. He doesn't say specifically where. I will assume Berlin. But this entry suggests that he did not plan the fires and did not know whether German property was safe. This entry contradicts his November 10th entry, where he says that German businesses were never at risk.
Ah.
Yeah. And one more time, he uses that bravo with an exclamation mark.
Yes.
When he finds out that Jews were no longer allowed to study at universities. So.
Very inconsistent.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, the Tagebücher are finished. It's over. I mean, I went through all those entries and there's just too many questions. Even if some of it is legitimate, it doesn't matter. When somebody has doctored a document, if you don't have a set of experts that can go through and cross out the fraud, and Ingrid can, she crossed out the fraud in the Schallermeier document, and it makes total sense when you strike out the fraud. But she took a long time to be able to do that. She's an expert in documentation, and she can look at these documents and knows when it's a fraud because she knows what German documents are supposed to look like from that era. Now, somebody like Steinweiss or others who aren't as well read in this documentation expertise. Now, I don't know if he is in particular, but it doesn't seem like it, seeing as how he just accepts all these accounts in that NS High Court report without even questioning it. You're just not going to know you're being fooled.
Right. Exactly. And the people who read these books, they are just going to accept all of this as truth. And of course, it goes along with all of the other lies and all the other propaganda. So, well, of course the Germans did it. Of course,
right.
The NSDAP did it.
Right. And I've got 4 books on Kristallnacht now, and all of them contradict all the other ones. But unless somebody buys several and reads several accounts of something instead of just jamming onto Wikipedia, they're not going to know about these inconsistencies and lies.
Exactly.
So.
Well, this is very, very fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I still have like 50 more pages where I go through Ingrid's. You know, so I'm going to publish this, though. So, you know, we don't have to spend an entire another radio program on it. I'd like to get on to Gleiwitz next time, but I'll have it published.
Okay.
So people will be able to have the whole case, everything we've gone over in all its detail in published form.
Great. And that will be published where?
That I'm currently working on. Okay. I'm going to publish it myself. I'll put it out in a book, but it's just right now a matter of finding the time.
Okay.
I've gotten a little extra busy lately.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Now you were writing articles for another website?
Inconvenient History?
Uh-huh. Did you want to talk about that at all?
I'm kind of done with those. I just haven't had time to produce anything that they're particularly looking for, because generally they'll have like a theme.
Oh, I see.
There's a certain issue. And if you don't have something prepared along the theme, it's not readily accepted. And it's like, I just don't really have time right now to produce anything. I suppose I could try to do something on Kristallnacht, but right now it's just JRAW that I'm posting anything on.
Sure.
So,
alrighty.
I mean, I'd like to get more publications out, but at this point, a little tight on funding and time. So, I'll get it out as soon as I can. So, I'm pulling the old triple shift to be able to publish all this stuff.
Oh, bless your heart.
So, oh, yeah.
What a trooper you are.
Yeah. Has to be that way, unfortunately, because not a lot of people are as fanatical about the literature as I am. So
I think it's just plain dedication, and it's a dedication to the truth. And I just admire your scholarship and your tenacity, and your attention to detail is just wonderful.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I'll keep doing it. There's no swaying that. But I'll get these publications out.
Great.
So I'll come up with a title and let people know closer to when it's scheduled. But, you know, we do have a lot of books out already.
Right.
The Four Wolves series. Unfortunately, I had to kill off the first book because I just can't afford to keep it in print.
Oh.
That's why a lot of the titles are falling out. Of print is because they just can't afford to keep them going. So, I'm keeping the most important ones out there, but the Werewolves of the Iron Cross and New Look at Iller's Armed Forces, that's gone. I just can't keep that going, and I can't reprint these things either. So, and, you know, the printer I have now, they have to have different. Everything has to be changed, like the size of the file and stuff, the dimensions and the
uh-huh.
cover. And that's beyond my skill level. So they can't, I just can't bring them back into print because of that.
Wow.
I know. It gets a little intense. The
Yes.
old publishing industry.
Yes. Well, you're certainly doing a great job.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you for being on the program. People
Okay.
really appreciate what you do. They really do.
I appreciate what you do, and thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.